Ein herzliches Willkommen bei Die Quotenfrau, Fluch oder Segen. Dein Empowerment-Podcast von Frauen für Frauen. Mit wertvollen Karrieretipps, spannenden Insights und neuen Ideen. Mein Name ist Ursula Helmel und ich freue mich sehr, dass du heute wieder mit dabei bist. Grüß euch und herzlich willkommen zur Quotenfrau. Heute mit einer sehr aufregenden Premiere, denn ab jetzt geht's auf Englisch weiter. I'm incredibly excited because this interview will be in English. I also have an amazing woman as a guest. I heard her on a panel where she said some great things, including if you fall, fall forward. Sharon is a native New Yorker and has lived in Vienna, Austria for over 2 decades. She enjoys traveling with her husband and with her son. She has leadership experience over 3 decades in healthcare management and IT, including European and global executive roles. She aims to help women advance their careers while maintaining personal well-being, providing the tools and strategies needed to succeed. Sharon's expertise and personal journey prepared her to guide women to her next level of greatness. I'm so happy. Thank you, Sharon, to be with us. Hello again.
Hi, Ursula. Thank you for inviting me here for this discussion. It's my first interview on what primarily is a German-speaking podcast. So this is also a premiere for me as well.
Oh, well, I'm so excited. And I want to start right in our discussion with a question I always ask. What do you think of the quota?
Quotas. So you mean quotas in hiring women or people from underrepresented identity groups and organizations? Yes. The answer is a firm yes. And the reason I say that is because I believe that what doesn't get measured doesn't get done. It's very simple. I have a long corporate career, so I understand what it means to have targets and key performance indicators. And the fact of the matter is, if you don't hold people's feet to the fire to get things done, they simply won't do it. They will have a million excuses that there weren't the right candidates in the pipeline, or the candidates weren't qualified enough. And if they have a quota, it makes them look harder. It makes them think a little bit beyond what their image is of the right candidate, and makes them hopefully expand their thinking, hopefully with the help of a really good recruiting support team from HR or from personnel development or something like that. I think the other thing I want to add to that is that not all managers have the skills needed to identify and interview candidates, which I think is also a reason that leads to an over-rotation on hiring people that are the same as themselves, because that's within their comfort zone. And they don't know how to interview. They don't know what the right questions are to really understand the value that a candidate is bringing to the table.
Mm. And in your career, did you see the difference between KPIs and not KPIs for women?
Well, yeah. I mean, throughout my entire career, I have witnessed it. Unfortunately, you know, there is not absolute equity, and nor do I believe that there has to be 50-50 representation, but I think that there has to be representation. And so what I can tell you is, as I was climbing up through my career and elevating myself from mid-management to upper management to executive to global executive, the further I climbed up the food chain, the less women there were in the room. It's very simple. Mm. Not only were there less women in the room, but the turnover of the women was much more accelerated than the turnover of the men. And the reason why the turnover was much more accelerated is because not only does it get lonely at the top, and I'm saying this using quotes, but there starts to become an understanding that after a woman has really fought really hard to climb the ranks of an organization, whether that is in the private sector or even as a figure working in the public sector. The expectations on a woman are completely different than those of a man. And that coupled with that we still have in Western societies gender roles where women still are responsible for managing everything in the household for their children, their adult children, their elderly parents, there is an enormous amount of pressure and stress on them. And sometimes it necessitates them having to step out and re-strategize how they're going to move forward in their careers.
Did you get to this point?
Yeah, I did. Actually, that was the whole stimulus for me actually leaving corporate and starting my own business. So there were a lot of factors, and I don't want to bore your listeners with all of them, but there were some pivotal moments in my career and my life, which I think are worth mentioning. One of them was that I was a caregiver to my mother who had a massive stroke and became disabled. You know, so she was partially paralyzed. She couldn't talk. And that happened while she was in Vienna. And I had to take care of her. And my son was still in elementary school. And I had an international job where I was meant to travel around the whole of EMEA. It was an EMEA role. And I was the director of sales enablement. And you can keep that pace up for a while, but what happens is it's just not sustainable. You know, so I had a team that I was leading, so I was also a people manager. I also had KPIs that I had to deliver. So effectively, my job role was to educate the sellers so that they could sell more. So my measurement was very much dependent on the sales of the organization. And so those numbers are real. Mm. You sell or you don't sell, right? So it's very easy to measure the effectiveness of the activities of my team and I. And there was an enormous amount of pressure to deliver the goods. And if it was software, and software is a very competitive business, and it was very tough. And what happened was I was on holiday with my husband. We were in Thailand. I managed somehow to find a caregiver for my mother and our young son. And I just started to cry, and I couldn't stop crying. And it was just like the floodgates had opened. And this poor man was sitting across the restaurant table from me, not knowing what was going on. And so basically, it was almost, I wouldn't say I had a nervous breakdown. I wouldn't go that far. But basically, everything just reached the breaking point, and I realized I couldn't go on any further. Now, the fact of the matter is, I'm the kind of person who doesn't like to ask for help. And a lot of women are like that. We somehow have been raised to think that we have to play nice, we have to be nice, we have to look nice, we have to take care of everybody first, and we put ourselves in the last position. And I was guilty of doing that myself. And I had to go forward, and I had to find a way to get resources to support me the best way that I could. And I also had to rethink the way that I was working. I had a really great team, and I had to use my team more and empower them more to work independently. I never considered myself a micromanager, but there was much more opportunity for them to contribute more. And so all of those things combined helped me find a better path for myself. And eventually, years later, I left corporate. And that's a whole different story, but it at least gives you an idea of one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about talking to women. I want to spare them from some of the experiences that I've had and that I've witnessed my clients have as well. It doesn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. We can be a little bit more strategic, and we have a lot more control than we think we have.
Oh, that's a nice sentence. Let me go a little bit deeper. What was the first thing you did that you can go out from this situation?
Yeah. The first step I took was I realized that I had to get help. Mm. And in this particular instance, I'm fortunate enough that I was able to afford help. So I was able to find a young woman to help me with my mother. So I didn't outsource it, but at least, you know, my mother had a companion and wasn't relying on me 100% to be her caregiver, to be her best friend, to take her to all of her medical appointments. The important things I kept, but the things that I felt were non-valued had, I outsourced to someone else. That was the first thing. The second thing was that I stopped saying yes to every single business trip. Every time there was a meeting, those were pre-pandemic days I'm talking about, where everybody was flying all across the globe. And every time there was a meeting and they said, oh yeah, let's do it in Bucharest, let's do it in St. Petersburg, I would always say yes. And I didn't have to. And so I started to realize that no is a word that can exist in my vocabulary. And I started to use it without having guilt. And that's what's really important, is to understand that you can say no without destroying relationships. You can say no, but offer people alternatives so that they don't feel like they're being let down. And I would say that that was one of the major learnings from that whole life experience I had. So no is a complete sentence.
I want to go a step deeper into your history. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your life. Tell us how you came to Austria and what was your way?
Okay. So yeah, that was a long journey and it definitely was not linear by any stretch of the imagination. So I, as you mentioned in the opening of the podcast, I'm a native New Yorker. I was born and raised in New York and specifically raised in the Bronx in public housing, which I don't know if you understand what public housing means, but this is government housing, low-cost housing for people who have very low incomes. So I come from a family of very humble beginnings, you know, working class people, not educated, good, decent people with good values, but we just didn't have a lot of resources, and I went to underfunded schools. But there was one thing that was always key to me, was that I was curious and I always wanted to learn. And so education became important to me. And I was very lucky when I was in elementary school to have some teachers who identified that I had some special talent. And so they put more energy into me and started to open my eyes about possibility. So I will fast forward because we don't want to go through that year by year. But I eventually got into university, and I was the first person in my family to go to university. So I left the Bronx and I went to a private university, also in New York, but in Long Island. And I got to experience another way of living, a way of living where I didn't have to be afraid to come to my neighborhood, because I lived in a crime-ridden neighborhood during the crack era, you know, so there was a huge drug epidemic when I was coming of age, which makes any neighborhood very unsafe. And all of a sudden, I was living someplace that was safe. I could walk in the streets. I also came to the realization that I was poor. I didn't know how poor I was until I went to private school and I saw how much other people had. And on one hand, it created a bit of self-consciousness that I realized that I was very different from everyone else. But on the other hand, I didn't view my schoolmates or my university mates as being any smarter than I was. So I knew that I could get what they had. I could do more. I just had to apply myself. And so university was tough. I had to work through it. I always had a job, almost, you know, 25 hours a week because I had to pay for it. My parents didn't have any money. And then eventually I graduated and I started my career. And now we will fast forward many, many years. And I completed an MBA in hospital administration. Something that was really important for me when I started my MBA was I wanted to know what I was working for and who I was working for. And so it was absolutely unattractive for me to go work for a bank or in finance. That wasn't interesting. I wanted to work where I could add something to the community. So I did an MBA in hospital administration and management. And I took a job upon completing my MBA at one of the largest private Jewish hospitals in New York, which is called Mount Sinai Hospital. And I became an administrator. That was my first management job, and I had a huge team. And that eventually, after being there for years, that's how I met my husband, who was an Austrian man, and he was doing a research fellowship at the same hospital. And we met, and a love story ensued, and then I ended up in Austria, and I moved here in 1999, so we're talking about a lot of years.
What an impressive story. Let me go through your leading positions. What do you think? Which skills a leader needs most?
Well, there's something that there are skills that used to be classified as soft skills and that were not considered very valuable for a long time. And soft skills are your ability to communicate, to listen, to have empathy, to anything that has to do with one human relating to another. And these were devalued for quite a long time, particularly in the time where, you know, the internet bubble was, you know, growing and people were making a ton of money. And somehow those skills just became unimportant. What we really understand is a good leader needs to have these skills. And I don't like that they're classified as soft skills, but a good leader needs to have the skills and the ability to connect with other people. It doesn't mean that you have to be in love with the teams that you're leading, that you have to be best friends or cross any boundaries, professional boundaries, but there is a way to lead, to respect the dignity of the people who are working for you and with you, and treat them in a way that they need to be treated. That's one part of it. The other part of it is, if you're a leader, your goal, at least in my view, is to make sure that everybody around you shines, right? So this means identifying the potential in people, helping people grow, pushing them, giving them stretch projects, giving them the resources they need, like in terms of time to have a mentor or to do an education or something like that. Not this greed that everything good that happens in this organization or team is a result of me as the leader. I'm the rock star here. This is the absolute wrong approach. And what happens is when you enable your team and they understand that you're on their side and that they have the possibility to grow, you all win as a unit or as an organization. And I think this is absolutely essential. I think luckily, lots of businesses are starting to come back to the roots and understanding that this is important. But you know, let me be clear, the time that we spent sequestered during the pandemic did not help people in maintaining or developing their social skills. If anything, they have eroded. And our willingness to think that communication is just chatting with people in short sound bites has eroded it even further. So there's still a lot of work to be done. But when leaders get it right, they see the rewards for it.
You told us about the soft skills. Did you have them from the beginning on? Or did you learn about your soft skills as a leader?
Well, I think every leader evolves. I mean, naturally, there are characteristics that I have always had. I've always had the characteristic that I like to listen to people's stories. I love stories. I love life stories, journeys on how people got to where they are, stories about how relationships have evolved, etc. And so that has always been my curiosity, which I think has helped me tremendously. It also is a hindrance because I can give you real examples of when I understood the details of my teams or my employees' lives to such a great extent that it made it difficult for me to lead them because I was always considering, oh, I know she has this problem with her husband. I can't ask her this. You know, so there is a way to take it too far. So what I will say is that some of these superpowers I was born with and some of them I developed with time. I mean, it's, you know, in each year and in each phase of your career, you get this maturity. And, you know, there is something that's called the maturity curve, and you start to mature as a leader, hopefully. And the other thing that happens as an adult is your values become more solid. So you start to know more about who you are and what's important to you. And this definitely happened to me. And what happens with that, and that can also be very tricky, is once you start to understand more about your values and who you are, this means you can't work for everyone, because not every organization or every leader you have shares those values. And then it becomes very challenging to work in an environment where there's a disconnect, and then you have to make decisions. And I've had to do that in the past as well. Sometimes it's not always obvious. There were times when there was a disalignment of values or misalignment of values, where I thought if I did more, I could somehow close the gap. But actually, it wasn't about me. It just meant there was not the right sort of harmony or environment there. And I had to move on and find a place where it made sense for me to work.
So you would say you know who you are now?
Well, absolutely. Without a doubt.
And who are you?
Who am I? So, I mean, you know, I am a middle-aged American woman who is a voracious reader. I love reading everything, including Instagram, you know, so it's not just books, but I love reading the news. I'm very well informed. I am a mother, which for me is one of the most important roles I have had. I have a 23-year-old son who is very much still in my life, and I'm a wife. I've been married for going on 26 years, and a daughter and a sister. So, of course, you see, if for me, I know who I am. All of those things are about the people in my life. I have the advantage of living in Europe for such a long time that I got to pick my chosen family. Because, of course, I have family in the U.S., a very small family, I might add. And so I've been lucky enough to meet people who I've known for decades here, who are like my inner circle. I'm not a person that needs to have tons of friends, but the friends that I have are good friends. So I'm also a good friend. That's the other thing that I am. In terms of my professional profile, I'm someone who wants to deliver value. I don't want to waste people's time. I'm not coin operated. I like to make money the same way everyone else likes to make money, but I don't want to do it at the expense of my reputation or at the expense of disappointing someone. And so if you hire me to do something, you will get 1,000% from me. There's just no other way that I'm going to deliver that. So that's the person that I am as well. I'm also a cookie baker. I love to bake in my spare time. This is probably the only artistic expression that I have. And I love jazz music. And I could probably go on with some other descriptions, but I think I'll leave it at that for now.
What are your values? The three most important.
That's a tough question. You should have asked me that one in advance so I could think about it. I think one value that I think is really important is to be honest with people. And it's the difference between being honest and being brutally honest. I can be honest and tell you something about yourself or explain something about a situation without being harmful. And this is really important. And what I notice now, because I do read a lot of news and understand what's going on in the world, there is a lot of dishonesty, putting forward narratives that are completely divorced from the truth, and people are believing it, and it's really unfortunate. So honesty is one of my values. I also value that everybody has agency. I have agency to make decisions about my life, about where I want to work, about who are my friends, even who in my family I want to be connected with or not connected with. That is my right as an emancipated human, not even as an emancipated woman, is that I have agency, and I believe everybody should have agency. Doesn't mean that everyone has it, but I believe everyone should have it. So that would be the second one. And the third one, I have to have a good think on that one. I'm not sure I have an answer. It might come back to me a little bit later.
When we look at your journey, at your career, Did you set yourself goals?
I did. I when I started my career, like I said, I wanted to be a leader in a hospital, and I started on that trajectory. So I got my first job, and then I got promoted to the next one and was learning and getting more experience and being promoted. And then, of course, this love story ensued that I told you about. And there went the linearity and the growth in that career, because it was completely interrupted. And I moved to Austria. I couldn't speak two words of German. Healthcare in Austria is very different than healthcare in the US. So all of the skills in my work experience became absolutely meaningless. So I had to start from zero again. And I didn't know what that looked like in a foreign country. And then I had no goals. My only goal was that I would get any job when I moved to Austria. And the first job I took was working at the Berlitz School in the city center on the Traben, teaching English to business executives. So you have to imagine that I left a six-figure salary to then earn 150 shillings an hour. Think about this. And 150 shillings, I guess, is equivalent to maybe 10 euros an hour. So basically peanuts. But I didn't see it as a humiliation. I saw it as a necessary rite of passage that I had to go through to be independent, because I never imagined myself having to rely on my husband for money. And I also saw it as a mechanism to help me make my own friends. It was very important for me to build a social life for myself here. And I took a job at IBM. 6 months later, I took a temporary job at IBM, and I stayed there for 15 years. But I have to tell you, the first 7 years of working at IBM, I did not see that as my career. I wasn't planning anything. Anytime a promotion came my way, I just accepted it. I wasn't strategic. You know, I just was going through the motions. And I had a mentor, and she said to me, "Can I ask you what you're doing?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she says, "You know, every time there's a gap and your name comes into the discussion, you never say no. You're zigzagging all over this company. What is that about?" And at first I was insulted, because I thought, well, isn't that what you should be doing? But then I really thought about what she was saying. And after that, then I started to plan my career. That's when I started to plan it, because then I realized, actually, I'm doing a lot of things I don't enjoy doing. You also have to understand, working in IT, you make a ton of money. So I wasn't necessarily enjoying what I was doing, but I was getting paid very well for doing it. And sometimes that's a hard combination and a bad, it's tough to break out of it, because you're like, well, if I do something else, I won't make as much money, right? But eventually, as I said before, I realized that money was not the only driver in my life. It's important, like it is for everybody, but wasn't the main driver. And then I started to get strategic, and I started to make plans for myself. But the other thing was, I wasn't rigid in my planning. I always left room for other possibilities. I always had a side hustle too, always, because I understood very early on how it works when you're a corporate citizen. They love you until they don't. And then they kick you to the curb and you have nothing left. And for many people, they identify so much with their work that this can be an actually life-altering event, not to mention the loss of income, but just in terms of their identity. And I never wanted that to happen to me. And so I always had a side hustle. And my side hustle was that I was always doing leadership workshops outside of IT, because I didn't want to have a conflict of interest. So it's no surprise that I ended up eventually in this business, because that had been something that I was nurturing over the years and getting more skillful at developing people, understanding where the potential in people lies. And it was great, because I always had extra money on the side to buy my airline tickets to go back to the US. So a very long-winded answer to your question, but I hope that I got to the point there.
Of course. What would you like to pass on to young women for her career?
I think it's important for young women to understand that they can ask for more, that working hard is not the only answer. If you work hard and you keep your head down and expect that people are going to recognize this, you are in for a huge disappointment because it just doesn't work like that. It's great to have a good work ethic. I believe in that. But you have to be visible, and you also have to talk about the things that you've done. And there was a piece of advice that I got ages ago from a woman who was my boss at the time. And she said to me, keep a file and just always note every time you have a win, no matter how big or how small it is. And this is advice I'm always telling people all the time. We're lucky now. We all have smartphones. We have a notation device in our phone where you can write every single week, you know, whatever you consider the end of your week, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And you just reflect and say, what were my wins this week? What did I do? And, you know, sometimes the win doesn't have a KPI attached to it. Sometimes the win is about, I advised a colleague who was going through a difficult time, helped her get through that. Or, you know, I wrote this report and I got this really great feedback from person X, right? And so what happens is when you start to accumulate all of these wins, you start to understand, oh, wait a second, I'm valuable. I add value. And nobody can take that away from me. And I think it's very hard for women, particularly young women, to see that because they think everything has to be big and everything has to be enormous in terms of what they achieve. But what I always say is the cumulative impact of all of the small wins is also powerful. It's powerful. The other thing I would say is work for impact, not for the sake of being busy. All of us do it. I mean, I do it all the time where I'm, you know, I get to the end of the day and I just like, what did I do today? Because I was running around like a chicken without a head, being busy doing things as opposed to being busy being effective, right? And so there is a huge distinction there. So I would really encourage women to think about that. And then I'm going to mention something that has nothing to do about my profession, but I think is so important. And this is managing money. Women should think more about their financial future earlier in their life. That means when you get paid, taking a small percentage and putting in the savings or, you know, some financial tool or instrument so that you don't touch it. I went to a networking meeting recently, and every young woman, and I would say the women were like between 27 and maybe maximum 40, they had Dior bags and beautiful jewelry and wonderful designer clothes. They were, you know, each one was wearing between 3,000 and 7,000 euros worth of clothing on their back. They all looked amazing. And I was just thinking to myself, I wonder how much they have saved for when they need it. This is so important because you know what? There is a gender pay gap. And in this country where you and I live, this gender pay gap is quite significant, but it exists across the globe. And so the notion that you will get paid well for your work and be paid fairly has been disproven. We know that, right? And so that means that by the time you finish your career, the amount of salary, pension, and everything you have will always be less than your male counterpart. So you have to somehow bridge that gap by preparing and taking charge of your financial future. And that means it's never too soon to hire a financial consultant to give you advice. Even if that person charges you a little bit of money each year, do it. You will be happy. And if you do it, tell me that you've done it, because I think that that is a way to empower yourself as a woman to be responsible for your financial health.
One question before we came to our end is, to the end of the episode, is when young women or women in their middle age are coming to you, what is it your work about? Yeah. So how do you empower people?
Well, as you mentioned, I have a company that's called Living While Leading, where I provide executive coaching services. I also do workshops for small groups and for large groups, for corporate. And one of the things that I do when I have a private client, so someone who's decided to invest in herself, either in a one-off coaching session with me or with a longer coaching engagement over 5 months, is to really get her to understand what's important to her. You asked me earlier what my values are, right? And first, I think it's really important for my clients to articulate what it is that they want, right? Oftentimes, they want coaching, and then I say, well, what do you want? And then, you know, they're a little bit fuzzy on it. And so one of my responsibilities in this role is to get them to drill down on what it is they want and then to help them be strategic about how they're going to get there. Because hope is not a strategy, right? You have to plan. You have to do things. And it doesn't mean that it moves always straight ahead. Sometimes you make a few steps forward and then maybe a step to the side, maybe one backwards, but then eventually you get ahead. But this only happens with intention. And so my role as a coach is to get women to operate with intention and for impact. And those two things, if they manage that, they get what they want.
At the end of my episode, I have always little flashlights.
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So quick answers of quick questions. You told us before that you are always saying to women they should write mm-hmm. wins on. What's your win this week or last week?
Uh-huh. Well, I think my win was that I completed a good year of business with my company, Living While Leading. It's still quite a new company, and I can look back and I can see that I did a lot of things well. I need to change some things for 2025, but I think I did a lot of things that put me in the right direction.
How do you create a good work-life balance?
For me, it's prioritizing movement. I'm a lot older than you are. So, you know, exercising, moving, taking walks, that's really important for me. And it's a non-negotiable. It really is. I do it. Last night, I was tired, but I said, you know what? I'm going to take my walk. It was 7 o'clock at night. I did it because I know I sleep better. I need fresh air. And so that in itself, if I get that done, and if I manage that 5 days a week, this is already evening out a lot of things for me. Even if I've had the craziest day, it really helps me even things out. There are lots of other things, but for me, that's an absolute non-negotiable. Every woman should stand in her power.
And what would you like to say to your 20-year-old self?
Don't take everything so seriously. Have fun. You're young. You're beautiful. You have a lot of power, more power than you think. Enjoy yourself. Do the hard work, but at the same time, have fun.
Let's imagine that the end of your life, everything about you is suddenly deleted. Mm-hmm. Your homepage no longer exists. No podcasts, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
What message should remain?
Believe in yourself. You can do it.
Thank you. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Sharon, so much to join this podcast to be my guest. And the last words of this episode are yours.
Well, Ursula, thank you for inviting me. Thank you for coming up to me at this event. I think it is always very brave to talk to someone who you don't know, and courageous. And so I appreciate you talking to me. I think that it's a wonderful thing to have a podcast like this to amplify not only your voice, but the voices of other women. So consider that a contribution that you're making. I'm not sure if you thought about it in those terms, but you are making a contribution, and I think that's important. And I would encourage all young women to think about what contribution they're making to other women to support them. And I would end it there. Thank you.
Danke, dass du bis zum Schluss mit dabei warst. Falls dir die Folge gefallen hat, freue ich mich natürlich, wenn du sie weiterempfiehlst, wenn du sie teilst, wenn du sie bewertest. Und am meisten freue ich mich darauf, dich als Zuhörer im nächsten Mal wieder.
begrüßen zu dürfen.